Good afternoon. I'd like to introduce our next presentation, The Economics of Security Certifications, FIPS 140-2 Common Criteria and UCAPL. Please welcome the President of CoreSec Security, Mr. John Morris.
Thank you. Thank you for sticking around, not flying back home or falling asleep yet after lunch. So one of my goals will be to make sure we all don't fall asleep, hopefully. But I also wanted to, in this presentation, try and get some food for thought for everybody. So in the keynote, David was talking about his goal to provide inspiration to get us thinking. And one of the things that I've been noting is that there seems to be a common theme at ICMC that people are not focusing on why are we doing these validations. We're talking about all the technical issues. And I think that's a problem because, quite frankly, this is a conference that focuses on cryptographic module validation, and we're all insiders, security validation industry insiders, if you will. And so what we are doing is talking about lots and lots of technical issues, lots of programmatic issues, lots of details in there, but we don't always step back and take a look at the whole. And one of the things that I've been noting is that FIPS 140-2 in particular, but many of the validation programs and certification programs that we deal with, like Common Criteria and UCAPL, are really aging very rapidly, and they're not changing to address the requirements that are coming up, the new threats, the new products, the new technology, and the timing and speed of those validations. And lots of people are talking about it and saying that we need to do things to address that. So I'd like to talk about what those drivers are, what we need to do, and how we can actually do that. So that's what I'd like to do. I guess I should say that I don't intend to provide any criticism or critique, even if perhaps some of my slides sound like I'm complaining about aspects of the validation programs or the like, but I'm simply bringing them up because I say I think we need to take a look at why we're doing those things and see if that spurs us to do something else. And really, if you go back and look at it, we talk about why we're doing these. It's not technical issues that we should be worried about. It's the economics that are driving what we're doing. So what are the drivers for certification? Is it because there's new security threats that we need these certifications out there? Or is it the new attacks that require people to go and get these validations? Has there been growth in FIPS 140-2 validations, for instance, because we need new uses for cryptography, because we have new cases, new businesses that are deploying this? Are new technologies and evaluation certification efforts the one that are pushing it? I don't think so. I think what's actually pushing it is, of course, money. Economics are the drivers for the certifications. And one of the things that I believe is that this is actually what you could view as a sort of a tertiary market. And the primary driver for certifications actually comes from the growth of IT. So at first, we're talking about people actually putting functionality out there. And this has been happening ever since Y2K. So post Y2K, everyone's like, oh, now it's the new era of we're actually going to spend money on computers and put out information technology and automate everything, and we're going to get a lot of stuff going. And that did happen. And you could see IT spending increasing every year ever since then. But what we did not see every year was the direct impact to security. Instead, security followed on and lagged behind the growth in spending increase for IT. So that's a secondary market where we start saying belatedly oftentimes after we put out the functionality and say, look, you can reach the bank from anywhere. And then we say, wait a minute, did anyone bother securing so that we, when we reach the bank from anywhere, other people that we didn't want to reach the bank, okay, we need security. And so belatedly, they start deploying security. And that security, that secondary market, then gets a heavy focus on spending. And we've seen that growth year after year, this whole industry. If you guys have been going to the RSA conference every year, when I first started going there, I think it was 94, it was a much smaller conference. It was very focused and it was very technical. But every year, it not only grew, but it became less and less technical and more focus on business and economics, the drivers that were pushing that, because more and more money was coming into it. The third market, the tertiary market, the thing that I believe comes next, is what we're doing when we talk about cryptographic module validation, and that is third-party assurance that that security is actually doing something. So again, unfortunately, that lags behind. It's again belatedly that we ask, well, we went and bought security, and I bought a firewall, and I put it out there, and Does anyone know if that firewall does anything? Does anyone know if it's actually preventing attacks? Does anyone know if that firewall is better than the other firewall? And there's where people start asking, where am I getting the bang for my buck in security deployments? And so that tertiary market, that's what we're doing. And those economic drivers, that's what's really driving everything that we do here and should be influencing the way we look at these technical issues. So third-party validation industry growth, my opinion, it's driven by needing to direct that security spending more wisely to get return on an investment. So third-party assurance, that's an outcome of the need to get that ROI. And that's where we oftentimes with the validation programs don't come back and say, are we delivering value for the efforts that you have to put in to go through and get this certificate on there to the end consumer? Usually vendors are the most focused on that, and we deal with lots of vendors talking to us about what are my options for certification and can I not get certified? What's the impact if I don't get this certification on there? Will this impact my federal sales? Will this impact my ability to sell into these markets? If I do have to certify, how much do I have to spend? How can I spend less on doing that? And really, the driver to do certifications comes down to solely whether or not that certification investment, that budget, will make money. Will it be a positive ROI? More than that, will it be a significant return on the investment to justify the risk or justify the opportunity cost of putting money into those certification efforts? There's plenty of other things to spend money on. You can spend money on more marketing and sales efforts. You can develop more functionality and you can do more testing and quality. But if you're going to do security certifications, there had better be an actual return that's coming from that. That's what's driving the adoption of FIPS 140-2. So if you guys have participated in any of the cryptographic users forum as part of the ICMC efforts for common criteria, you'll know that one of the common themes there has been both that group and the government externally come in asking, how can you guys drive more adoption of common criteria? The same question could be asked here of how can we all drive more adoption of FIPS 140-2? And normally, that's sort of a non-plus for people of wait a minute, I don't get it. Why would you be asking me, particularly if I'm a vendor or a lab or a consultant, why would you be asking me that? It's the government's job to drive adoption of FIPS 140-2, and they do so by mandating it as a law. But that's not really true. Vendors have seen that that is a law in the U.S. for FIPS 140-2 for a long, long time. And it still is a decision whether they're going to participate in that every time based on economics. Because if they don't believe that complying with that law is going to bring them more sales, they're willing to forego it. They're willing to forego putting those security requirements into their products, testing against them, and then they'll try and sell around it. But they may absolutely eschew selling if they don't think there'll be a positive return on investment there for them. So I would argue it's the only driver that matters. You never have a vendor coming in and saying, we don't have anything to spend our budget on this year, so maybe we spend a few million doing FIPS Common Criteria and UCAPL. Can you all help us go and spend some time doing that? Never. Instead, it's I need to have a justification for spending any budget on certifications at all. If we don't have a specific ROI tied to this, then it doesn't make the budget this year. There's no need for us to spend needlessly on it. So tell me where I'm going to get that back. Well, let's look at what they're arguing about spending. What are the costs of validation? Again, that sort of depends on where you are, what you're trying to do, and what your experience with it has been before. Some folks will say that FIPS 140-2 is going to be about $50,000 all in to go through that process. Common criteria, a little bit more. UCAPL, about that order of magnitude. Others will tell you that it's a lot more. Easily, people spend $1 million going through a common criteria evaluation effort on their first time when you consider or they consider and tally up everything that they've spent internally and externally. But why is there such a range? What's the difference between spending 50 or half a million on a FIPS validation effort? How does that happen? And one of the things that I'm oftentimes frustrated with is that some folks who are not in the industry, and sometimes perhaps within the government or a new vendor who has not participated in this before, they're not aware of what the actual effort entails. They're not aware of how they could get through spending only $50,000. They're not aware of what would entail failure and spending $500,000 and not even getting a certification in the end. But what goes into those costs? Well, most people know that there's laboratory testing fees and government fees. Those fees are fairly obvious, fairly easy to quantify. You can go and look them up, or you can get a quick quote on doing it. They know that on the return side, to balance against that, they have improved security potentially and additional federal sales. They may even be able to go to their federal sales force and say, how much more will you promise me in additional sales if we're going to get these certifications to support those sales? And what they may be overlooking is additional areas that they're going to be spending on. So on the side of actually going through that process, there is a problem of understanding the requirements. Those of you that have read through the implementation guidance lately know that there's a lot of requirements, and they're actually evolving and changing, and applying them to any particular product or technology requires some knowledge and skills, requires some practice, requires some understanding that's in there. If you don't do that requirements assessment correctly up front, you're going to pay later on in the process, finding out that you haven't addressed certain requirements or you haven't met it. Similarly, people underestimate the requirement for architectural changes. I was hearing another presenter talking about the ability to do FIPS inside or to replace a module into a product. And we've worked with a lot of vendors on how to do that. One of the problems with that is it entails architectural changes to the products many times. Sometimes there are plug-and-play drop-ins that they can put in. Sometimes they're actually going to have to go through and retool their entire architecture, and it's not going to happen on the next version of the product. It's going to happen three or four versions of the product down the road when they do a major overhaul that includes architectural changes. But unless you assess that up front in the process, you're not going to be including that into the cost of it. If you're including that into the cost of it, well, now you're well into the millions for some types of products. Similarly, those product modifications can be extremely expensive, and you have to bake that into the cost of going through these validation processes. Some people like to argue that those product changes are improving the security of the product. But my experience is that few vendors view those security improvements as actual improvements, or they're definitely not bringing economic benefit to the customers in improved security with the product. There's also obviously a large amount of documentation that may have to be produced for vendors that don't already have extensive documentation, additional product cycles and releases that they may go through in order to get that validation product, that validation finished if they're going to have to make changes to the product, additional QA cycles and support, certification support time, the actual hours that they spend working with the laboratories and going through this process. All of that is part of what goes into that cost for a validation process if it's not planned for in advance. Those of you who have certification programs and do multiple products over and over again, you've addressed all of these areas already and therefore can minimize the cost of each validation as you go through. But the first time someone goes through, they may be surprised by all of that. So all of those costs, there may be additional benefits on the other side, but those benefits are really dominated by one thing, and it's the increased sales. On the cost side, the costs are dominated by internal costs, costs that the vendors have to spend, oftentimes unexpected, with their programmers, with their QA staff, with their developers, going through and adding additional activities to try and address or go through the actual certification processes. All of those costs can also be dwarfed by strategic costs. So one of the things that we learned early on in working with some of our customers was that it wasn't so much about the cost of the actual validation itself, it was the impact that that would have on the organization. And so we had a vendor come to us, said they needed to get validations done, and they needed to get three validations done within an extremely short period of time. And we said we can do that, but the problem is it will cost you more. because we will have to put multiple teams on there. We'll have to hire multiple labs at once. There'll be less efficiency. And it's going to cost you on the order of $50,000 or $100,000 more. If you would just put these in this sequence, we could save you $100,000. And they said, pretty much laughing, you don't seem to understand. We have $15 million riding on one sale for this product. It's software. And that $15 million represents pretty much all profit for us. So we have $15 million riding on getting it, and they're not going to give it to us unless we have these certifications. So you tell me, is $100K worth it for us to get that? And no, it's not going to meet that if you give us the other timeline and you save that money. Well, absolutely. I wish you'd told me $15 million was riding on it, because maybe we could up our pricing for it. But great. Now that that's the dominating cost, now that we know that that's what's there, we need to do everything we can to meet that timeline. And that strategic cost sometimes dwarfs, but the engineers don't necessarily see it, all of the costs of validation. If they're going to have a validation fail to go through and it's going to take 2 years, and we've seen people take 2 or 3 years and even give up on validation processes, during that time, their competition may have certified products. They may be selling. They may be gaining market share. Then they're gaining all the support and additional sales. Those costs can be extremely high. The other aspect on the opportunity side is how long does it take? Certification processes can drag on interminably if vendors are not prepared for, if they're not working with the lab, if they're not giving the lab all the information they need and the inputs they need to get through. How long does a vendor have to get through that process? And this has been a common theme at this conference and in the past. Vendors have said over and over again, in particular, that FIPS 140-2 is not commercially responsive in time frame. We're talking 9+ months to go through the process normally. And that's the abbreviated time fashion, assuming you know what you're doing, because there are so many delays built in once you've submitted to the government, once you're waiting for your responses and the like, that it's going to take you that time to get the certificate from the time that you start your testing process to the time that the certificate is actually posted on the website there. But 9 months is an interminably long time if your product cycle is releasing every quarter and if you have major revisions on a yearly basis. 9 months out of date is almost worthless for many products. They're having to go and explain to customers the latest version of the product that we're selling you is not certified, and it won't be certified for another 6 months or 9 months or whatever it might be in the time frame, because we can't go through the process faster than that. It's also true that the longer the process takes, the less likely to finish. Common criteria, its predecessors in the Rainbow Series, those evaluations were notorious for taking multiple years. Multiple years that might not end in the actual evaluation completion, but might end in the end of life for a product before they'd actually get the product completed. That's really not valuable economically for customers, and they're only playing the game sometimes to get the product into certification, to get it listed in evaluation, even knowing that they may not get past it to get it certified. And so one of the other problems with that is if the government is amenable to understanding that it'll take a long time, they do put in process lists, in evaluation lists, telling you that they're in there. And they do work with customers to tell people, yes, if it's on there, perhaps you can purchase or deploy the product ahead of time. The rules state no, but many vendors find that they're able to sell initially before they get their certifications. So length of certification, extremely important. 1 year of federal sales, a huge cost to people. And if you can start selling immediately, that's going to make your validation process much more valuable to you. But in the end, it may weaken the value of actually getting the certificate. So it's a difficult landscape to deal with. It's a difficult problem for a vendor looking at this saying, I really don't know how much it's going to cost me the first time I go in there. You tell me I have to do a FIPS validation and it's going to cost me between $50,000 and $500,000 to do. I can't tell you whether I'm going to get $500,000 on the outside of it. So unless I'm getting a couple million more on the outside of it, there's no point for me starting this process. Furthermore, if they come in and they expect it to cost $50,000 and it doesn't take that, then what are they going to do? And so I want to talk a little bit about what causes that and how that happens. because that cost landscape, that's what drives vendors away from doing validations. It also is what drives people away from participating in and furthering and extending the program for FIPS validation. In fact, I would argue that right now, CMVP is not growing customers of their certification program. There may be more certifications issued each year, but we are not getting additional groups adopting that standard and saying, I want my end users to buy only products that have been FIPS 140-2 validated. I would argue that we are actually getting a fracturing of groups saying, I'm going to perhaps participate, but I want to change it. I'm going to perhaps not require it, or I'm going to look entirely to a new standard. An interesting example would be HSMs, perhaps. HSMs are quintessentially cryptographic modules used by the banking industry. They're definitely the target market, in my mind, for a FIPS 140-2 validation. However, they have not contributed, that I've been aware, a huge amount back into designing or changing FIPS 140-2 requirements to meet their own requirements. Instead, they've come out with a separate validation program and standard against which they are going, because they believe that that is going to meet their needs, that that's going to be cost effective. And so if it costs you a significant amount to get one of these validations, when we talk to vendors right now about UCAPL, it's a newer program, and they're being driven to do it, and they're absorbing those costs. But longer term, they're going to talk to their customers, and they're going to say, really, you don't want me to get this validation. You don't want me to get this listing. What you want me to do is to do something else for you. And it will be cheaper, faster, and the end cost to you will be less on the products. And that means that the standard won't grow, won't evolve, won't add on something that's useful for all of those different communities. And so we have to look at why vendors would shy away from FIPS 140-2 or Common Criteria or UCAPL. So again, I'm not trying to critique or pick on things here, although it does seem or sound like I'm doing that. I'm just trying to give examples of what the issues are. And I find it's really valuable sometimes to delve into these details, because a lot of times, unless you actually go through the details of a validation yourself, unless you get mired in the arguments and the problems, a lot of times you may be unaware of the devil in the details, the monster in the jungle, the thing that you don't necessarily see the instant you look at the landscape and say, great, what's it going to take to get through? But then all those little hidden details suddenly whelm up and become a real problem. So the devil is in the details. And let's look at some of those things. What happens? Vendors are told, oh, it's a mandate, it's a federal law. You're going to need FIPS 140-2. I'm sorry, the government of Canada recommends it, and you're not going to purchase the products unless they've got that validation. So vendor says, great, I need FIPS 140-2 validation, I'm going to do it. All right, we'll get our engineers on it. They're smart guys, they can do this. Let's start it. What's the cost? What's it going to take for me to get through that? Well, not a problem. It'll be $50K, everything included. Went and got a quote from several people, talked to everyone. We're good to go. Let's start this process. Okay, so we'll get a FIPS 140-2 validation. Next thing, for instance, as we start to delve into it, oh, there's a little detail in there. We'll also need validated algorithms. Really? Yes. You have to have CAVP validated algorithms for each crypto module that's in there, all of the things like AES and such that you're doing. We want to test those as well. Okay, great. How much will that cost me? Oh, nothing. Don't worry. That's part of what we're doing, right? So we're already engaged to go through that. There's a CAVS tool that NIST has produced. It's going to be great. Okay, we'll put an engineer on that. Let's start our algorithm testing, at which point you start the hourly labor costs, as they start figuring out what are they going to have to do to actually go through that testing. Which algorithms are we going to test? Well, it turns out there are quite a few algorithms. And those algorithms are, well, they're actually split into little components, and there's pieces, and there's key management, and there's a few algorithms. Okay, the devil is in the details, but fine, let's start with those algorithms. So we're validating our algorithms. All right, great. Let's start with AES. We'll start validating our AES. So let's have the engineers do it. I'm tired of all these delays and all this uncertainty. Please get to validating those algorithms. Well, how are we going to do that? Well, The engineers come back and they say, well, we're going to write some interface code, and we're going to do test programs, and we're going to work with these standards, and we're going to go through and follow these special pubs, and do the modes of operation, we're going to get vectors, and we're getting test vectors, and oh my goodness. Okay, so the devil is in the details. So we needed FIPS validation. We started validating algorithms. We're doing AES. So by the way, there's 10 other algorithms that we're going to have to validate, but we're only going through this one. We're writing and testing our code to do the interfacing to it. We're debugging it, and we're having some problems. And suddenly, 2 man months have been spent on it already. And we're not done yet? No. Was that in the budget? No, that wasn't in the 50K. We didn't have anyone providing that service for us. But I thought algorithms were covered. Oh, they are. But you're going to have to figure out how to get the outputs from them. We're going to need a little more support to do that. And as the time starts adding up, certification can get delayed. So suddenly we went from, we're going to go through FIPS validations, to we're mired in the details of development and code development. I didn't think we had to do any of that. This was just a validation program where they were going to make sure that our product was secure against all these requirements, right? Yeah, but anyway, it turns out we have multiple implementations. What do you mean? Well, our one product has multiple cryptographic implementations in it, because we put that OpenSSL in there, but we also have that Java implementation, and the one that we purchased from the other vendor for the fast offloading of crypto. Yeah, all three of those validations we have to test. But then we also had the other ones that we didn't know we brought in, because remember when we put in PKI support, and then we did the DoD support for their logons? Each of those has its own crypto implementation. So suddenly we went from, we're testing AES, to, my goodness, I'm having trouble even tracking which certifications we're trying to get, and that's before we even figure out how we're going to get that one. So now we're going to have to repeat all of that for every single one that we're doing. And if you've been doing this, you already have your own internal solution for algorithm testing, where you're building your own internal tools and algorithm test code and the like to go through and do that. We, CoreSec, have done the same thing over the years. There was a presentation at this conference saying, hey, here we're going to start working at NIST to put in some of this as automated test code for people. Because this is one of those hidden areas that's a significant amount of cost that vendors don't see when they first jump into it. Oh, by the way, every processor model on each model that you have, it's of a different family, you're going to have to repeat it for those too. Oh, I really don't want to deal with this. And these types of scenarios, they very quickly turn into nightmare scenarios for customers who are going through it. That's where the 50K suddenly turns into 500K. We didn't expect to have our developers tied up for 6 months to a year trying to do some sub-picayune piece of this validation thing on cryptographic algorithms. We know our AES is good. This is ridiculous. Why do we have to do it? And what's really happened is, over the years, for all of these programs, the complexity of the programs has increased. The requirements have gone up, and it's a natural process. I've been involved in it. I'm sure many of you here have been involved in it. You get a new piece of technology, and you say, how does this fit into these requirements? Well, heck, it doesn't. Well, now we're going to have a big discussion and figure out what's the path forward for this particular technology and this particular application. Well, now that we've figured that out, we'll set some general rules for how we'll deal with that type of technology in the future. The next vendor comes along, they also have to read and understand those rules and abide by them, and any additional requirements that are there. And the evolution of those requirements, the additional scheme rules, implementation guidance, entropy rules is a favorite right now, protection profiles, algorithm rules, transitions, documentation requirements, testing steps, the sum total of all that is now in the, pick your poison. For FIPS 140-2, we're well over 1,000 pages of documentation just to understand the current set of requirements. And that doesn't include any of the lore that's out there of how they're actually applying these requirements, but haven't gotten around to or haven't been able to document for all cases. The same is true for programs like UCAPL we're seeing right now. UCAPL is a much younger program, and thus is refreshingly free of the built-up set of case law, if you will. But already we're working with the folks at the UCCO as we're coming up on new issues, new problems, and in fact, they're also requiring common criteria and FIPS for what they do, and so they're inheriting all the complexities of how do I actually say I want to do common criteria, but then deal with the fact that it only applies to this type of tow, but we're testing it for these environments, or the FIPS validation is not for all the models that we wanted to cover. And so as you start going into the complexities of it, suddenly supposedly simple processes become extremely unwieldy. But I would argue that the big problem is not with the cost. And this was actually one of the things that I remember having a discussion with some folks from NIST at one point. There was debate on how, when, and why should we increase the fee that was charged to vendors for going through the validation process. And my basic point was, it's moot. Increase the fee as much as you want, because the fees at the time were a couple thousand dollars. And a couple thousand dollars in a $50,000 validation effort was not that bad. But a couple thousand dollars in a $500,000 validation effort was really meaningless, utterly meaningless. Double it, triple it. It doesn't mean anything. What means something is if we can reduce the complexity and cost and time to go through the validation process. So one of the big successes recently for the program in my mind is that the validation queues came down significantly. And those validation delays that were in there, those were direct opportunity costs for vendors. If you reduce the time of validation by 6 months, that's six more months of selling that the vendor has on the life cycle of that product for that validation. That's direct money in the coffers. For a software product, as I was mentioning, the cost of producing the software, the next copy, the marginal cost of it, is almost negligible. But the revenue that they can get if they can find another government customer that finds it meeting all their requirements is straight to the bottom line, pretty much. So as you go through with this, I would argue that the complexity and cost of doing the validations have risen, and they've risen linearly over the years. The value from the certifications, however, has not risen at the same pace. It's not risen commensurately. And the reason for that is that there hasn't been additional enforcement or additional adoption, additional people saying, I'm not going to buy your product unless you've got this certification. So it's on the enforcement side that it hasn't been growing. It hasn't been amplifying that. It hasn't been a feedback loop there saying, I need to buy more and more products that are validated. So the question in my mind is, how do we address that? How do we improve that path? How do we find the right path for development and evolution of the standard to help it grow? And that's not easy. And it's not quick. And there is no trite solution. But the one thing that I think we could start thinking about is the need for that feedback, a feedback loop. If you think about it, one of the things that really fundamentally was not designed into some of these certification programs, like, and we'll take FIPS 140-2 as the example, is that kind of strong, tight feedback loop that allows impacts on the vendors, the cost to the vendors. The example I was giving you of, oh my goodness, you're going to do a FIPS validation, but the devil's in the details and all of these other things that will be levied upon you as requirements and all this other work that you're actually going to have to get to do in order to achieve that validation. That's the sum total of the cost. That's the all-in cost for the vendor to do this. That impact needs to be understood, needs to be measured, or at least looked at and quantified in some fashion, and fed back into what we're planning and what we're trying to do with the validation. That's impossible to do up front because you cannot foresee that. And certainly, I was one of the first labs going through, to become a FIPS at the time, 140-1 lab. And I remember going through the validation process, the accreditation process for the lab, and working with the folks from the CMVP at that stage, and arguing and talking about what these requirements would mean for different technologies and how we would apply them. But at the time, we were still literally talking about programs running under DOS and programs running under Windows, and whether some of these were poorly written requirements that would only support the environment for DOS and some would work on Windows. Anyway, that newfangled stuff with Mac OS, don't worry about that. But that, at that point, there was no way to predict how those standards needed to evolve to handle today's products, today's technology, and today's threats. And only if there were a strong feedback loop that constantly reevaluated that would we have the chance of changing the standard to meet that. But FIPS 140-2 was published quite a while ago now. More than a decade has passed since it was originally published. It has not evolved very quickly as a standard. There are changes to it. There's implementation guidance and other things. But it has not been constantly tweaked, constantly modified as a standard to deal with that. And so if you don't look at the impact to vendors, you're not going to have a responsive program. Similarly, you need to do the same thing with the consumer requirements. You'll hear the government folks here very, very mindful and very understanding from the start and always that their consumers are the government purchasers. The only reason they're saying people need to do FIPS 140-2 is so that those government purchasers can get products that meet their security requirements. But those government purchasers, they have the same problems of technology and the rapid change that everybody else does, and they're trying to struggle just as much as corporations are, and they're even coming up with new programs where they can go say, how do we use COTS, commercial off-the-shelf software? How do we use the current actual technology that's out there and not have to do government GOTS, government-purchased custom stovepipe systems, because those take too long, they don't come up with the new things we need, and they don't have the functionality, they don't react to the marketplace. How do we go to a COTS world instead of a GOTS world and yet still have security? And how do we get the certifications to match that as well? And unless we have a feedback loop for those consumers to come back and say, here's what my actual threats are right now, here's where I need to go, we're not going to be evolving that standard either. So what I'm talking about is a feedback loop, meaning what we do is we take security objectives and we say, what are we trying to do? What's the point of this? What are we testing against? What are the things that these modules in FIPS 140-2 world should not be vulnerable to? What's the assurance we're trying to cover? And then from that, we define, well, here's what that means in terms of security requirements for those products. And thus, we write the standard from it. Then we go and take that and have a testing program. We actually make sure that that standard is then put out to the vendor community, built into, baked into products, and we test and do conformance to make sure that it's actually in there so that the government can purchase those. But the next step is what we need. We can't just declare success and repeat. And I would argue that for more than a decade, we've declared success and repeated and said FIPS 140-2 is still applicable to everything. But unless we go back and say, we're going to have to take that and have a feedback loop that measures the effect of that standard, takes into account the costs, and then go back and assess frequently, how should we be changing that? Where are those costs too high? What needs modification? Continually improve the standard, but not based on what we think it should be, but based on what we're really seeing. As an example of that, PCI has a very, I think, strong feedback loop that they have perhaps more naturally, because when you're designing something that's going to, say, protect the communications in an ATM, okay, there are real-world attackers trying to get money out of the ATM and trying to break those systems. And they'll come up with some sort of skimmer, and they'll put it out there, and they'll collect people's PINs and information, and they'll steal money from a bank. What they do is, every time money gets stolen from a bank, they go and analyze, how did they do it? What did they? Sometimes they'll collect the skimmer and they'll say, great, what vulnerabilities are there in the products that we are designing, these PCI devices, these PEDs, what vulnerabilities are there that allowed them to make this kind of attack? And how do we modify our requirements so that future versions don't have these vulnerabilities and you can't steal money in the same fashion? That's a continual feedback loop that evolves their standard and makes it more valuable to the banks to purchase products that have been through that testing. And so hopefully such a feedback loop that we could design into a validation program would allow us to evolve it and focus on the most valuable activities. And that's one of the things that I don't think we're doing in common criteria, in FIPS, anywhere right now in this industry, is saying which of the testing activities that we do actually bring us value on the consumer side. Which of the things that we test for prevent real-world problems, security breaches, and cost money. So that feedback loop has to come from seeking feedback. We have to go and get measurements of the effectiveness of the program and its implementation. We have to see what are we actually doing. And that you have to go out into the industry, you have to go out in the real world, and you probably actually have to go out to the folks that are dealing with the ramifications of the failures of the system. You need to go and talk to the insurance industry, perhaps, and say, where are you guys suffering losses that are related to IT products, that are related to security breaches? And once you get that, you can come back and modify the standard, modify the requirements, both to augment, but also to subtract from them, perhaps, to change what you're doing to be most cost effective. Then you can come back with those modified objectives and say, now the threats are this, now the problems are this. This is where people are stealing money, if you will. These are the tests that we need to do with those objectives. And then in that feedback loop, you can have a change to it. And the key, I think, to that is who's involved in that feedback loop. It can't be only one set. It has to be all the stakeholders in the process. So as an example for a feedback loop, let's say you ask the government, what's your biggest issue? What's the problem now? And you find out that, and it's not, but let's just assume that it's backdoors being thrown into code. So people are throwing in code that has backdoors and then getting that compiled through the products. But we're not catching it currently in FIPS 140-2, say, because any code review that we do, they're not submitting the backdoored versions. Well, if this were the real problem, what would you do to deal with it? Well, we already have self-tests in FIPS. We've had them for a long time now. They've actually grown and we've added new self-tests, but there's no self-test that deals with this. But if we got together with a bunch of folks, talk to the labs, the vendors, we could probably say we can come up with a self-test that might address that. We can add one that does deal with that. Maybe we could add a requirement that says, let's have them give us the source code and have the lab verify that that source code actually produces these executables, that these executables are the ones that we validate, and that there's something provided to the end user that they will validate or they will do a fingerprint or make sure that they're getting the actual executables unmodified without additional backdoors thrown in. And we might find and decide that although that self-test would be expensive to implement and test, if we remove some of the other self-tests that this would now obviate the need for, we might actually have fewer self-tests and less testing to do. And therefore, in this hypothetical feedback loop, we would have taken the requirements from the end consumer, who's saying, here's my actual threat and problem right now, driven that back to, with the people who are involved in it, here's how we could mitigate that threat, and then change the requirements to say, I may even lower the bar for going through the validation, made it faster and easier to go through, but I've increased the security that I'm getting out of it. I've increased the value to the consumer because it's now addressing that requirement that we wanted. So in order to do that, well, we have to come down from the ivory towers, right? We have to get together and we have to work together. And what makes that feedback loop? Well, I would argue that this conference is one of the very things that is doing that. This was started by industry, if you will, at SEC, in cooperation with and with help from the government. But it was started, and since it started, I've seen more discussion in 3 years of ICMC conferences about these kinds of things than I have in a decade before that. Similarly, when everyone comes down from their ivory towers, and some, you can figure out who, comes up from their dungeons, and we get together and talk, we get new and surprising and different dialogues, ways to speed things up and ways to change things that we wouldn't otherwise have thought of. But of course, we have to be willing to embrace change as a process. And in case you're wondering, no, I have no idea what a peacock has to do with that concept, but I found a nice picture. So. But embracing change is difficult to do. It's threatening. And I've heard a lot of changes that people are talking about right now, and the first questions that come are, how's that going to affect my business? Or how's that going to affect my role in this process? And that is a valid concern, but as an industry, we need to come together and get above that. Personally, my business is only improved by things getting worse. We're consultants. We help people go through this process. The more burdensome the process, the more work for us to do. So quite frankly, I do not have an incentive to improve things. However, as an industry, I have every incentive to do so. Because if it gets too burdensome, the process isn't valuable to the end consumers, people will simply not do it and it will dry up and blow away. So flexibility and changes are both important and good. And we should all be looking for methods to rapidly adjust, to put in a feedback loop, to put in a process for us to change it. Common criteria in FIPS 14-2 did not undergo big revisions to deal with entropy. There weren't changes to the standard. There is no FIPS 14-3, but we're all dealing with entropy now. It is possible to make changes even outside the official ones. There's interesting ways we can do it. Automated testing could speed up things that we do. We could go through and have industry work more directly with government or put in new channels. There's lots of ways to do it, but there is the need, I believe, to continually lower that cost of certification. And that has not been a focus of a lot of the activities that we're doing. We've focused on the need to increase the technical complexity, to increase the security requirements, to do more on the technical side. Rarely do we step back and say, how do we actually increase the return on investment for everybody on this program? And I think if we have a method to do that continually, we'll find that the program will start to evolve and will start to evolve rapidly. So I encourage you guys to consider that and to look for opportunities to work together. I argue this conference is one, and your continued participation in this conference each year is much of that kind of stimulus for doing it. But there's also other things like the CCUF and the CMUF, which you've probably heard about, especially at our keynote. And in those groups, as a vendor or a lab or a consultant or just a concerned party or the government, you can actually work together and start topics up and work to improve things. It takes effort and it takes money to do that and to support that, but I highly encourage you guys to do that. And actually, I see Matt Keller is in the back of the room until his, I think his flight is leaving soon. But he's actually running some CCUF activities and CMUF activities. So if you have questions for him on how to get engaged with that or to work with that, you can absolutely ask me or him, and we can direct you the right way. So that's my presentation. Thank you all for listening, especially right after lunch. I hope it wasn't too much of a sleep inducer. But I really encourage you guys to consider and take a new tack on how do we evolve this standard going forward. So thank you all.
Thanks, John. We got time for a couple of questions.
Well, didn't quite do it right then. Is there any questions or comments?
Hi, John. Just actually a comment. Thanks for the presentation. It was very good. I think one of the things that perhaps isn't highlighted, or it was there, but maybe not all people see. I have the luxury or the bad luck to direct both Common Criteria Lab, FIPS 140 Lab, and a PCI Lab. So there are different philosophies in all of those testing. And what I found with certainly FIPS 140, as you said, is quite old. We're almost up to the third update after Dash 2 that should be coming out. It's a very prescriptive conformance testing, and it gets out of date very quickly just because it is prescriptive. Whereas on the totally other end of the spectrum, PCI evolves a bit quicker, but it's more about what are the threats, doing the vulnerability assessments, scoring, you know, what is the risk, and adjusting quickly to that. And while Common Criteria does have that capability, unfortunately, some of the move towards the PPs have become very prescriptive, test only this and nothing else, and don't look at the vulnerability assessment. And I find that those are gonna, you know, age out very quickly. I just wanna see what your thoughts were on that.
No, I think that's an excellent point. And it's Aaron Connor with EWA, for those of you who don't know Aaron. And I would agree with not only the comment, but also the sentiment. But I would say that I think the idea of having evolution and having improvement in there and looking at it from an economic one applies in my mind to all of those areas, even given those differences, which you're correct on. But I would say as an example, Common Criteria, I can remember a time not that long ago when there were no protection profiles or very few that were viable for many types of products. And new protection profiles were created only from government groups. Now we have a concept of collaborative protection profile development wherein international involvement is encouraged, industry involvement is encouraged, and we can actually get a little bit more collaborative input that results in a better product for those protection profiles. And that was a very difficult process, I believe, for everyone to get to allow that. And the CCUF and you know its predecessors, the CVF, were instrumental, I believe, in opening a dialogue with the government and saying everyone had an investment here to make, but that everyone had a benefit to get if we could all come together and produce protection profiles that were more responsive, that were less rigid, and that and the like. So yes, each one, you're absolutely right, has different challenges to face, but I think we can improve in almost any of the areas, and I fear that the lack of improvement means stagnation and or death eventually. So, very good. Time?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Five, seriously. Just a five.
Okay. That should be one. Okay.
Yep.